8. It's easy to get lost in any big city hospital, but Hodges has made this trip plenty of times, and these days he's more apt to give directions than ask for them. The garage elevator takes him down to a covered walkway. The walkway takes him to a lobby the size of a train terminal. The corridor A elevator takes him up to the third floor. A skyway takes him across Kiner Boulevard to his final destination, where the walls are painted a soothing pink and the atmosphere is hushed. The sign above the reception desk reads, "Welcome to Lakes Region Traumatic Brain Injury Clinic. No cell phones or telecommunications devices allowed. Help us maintain a quiet environment. We appreciate your cooperation." Hodges goes to the desk where his visitor's badge is already waiting. The head nurse knows him. After 4 years, they are almost old friends. "How's your family, Becky?" She says they are fine. "Son's broken arm mending?" She says it is. "The cast is off, and he'll be out of the sling in another week, 2 at most." "That's fine. Is my boy in his room or physical therapy?" She says he's in his room. Hodges ambles down the hall toward room 217, where a certain patient resides at state expense. Before Hodges gets there, he meets the orderly the nurses call Library Al. He's in his 60s, and, as usual, he's pushing a trolley cart packed with paperbacks and newspapers. These days, there's a new addition to his little arsenal of diversions, a small plastic tub filled with handheld e-readers. "Hey, Al," Hodges says, "how you doing?" Although Al is ordinarily garrulous, this afternoon he seems half asleep, and there are purple circles under his eyes. Somebody had a hard night, Hodges thinks with amusement. He knows the symptoms, having had a few hard ones himself. He thinks of snapping his fingers in front of Al's eyes, sort of like a stage hypnotist, then decides that would be mean. Let the man suffer the tail end of his hangover in peace. If it's this bad in the afternoon, Hodges hates to think of what it must have been like this morning. But Al comes to and smiles before Hodges can pass by.
"Hey there, detective. Haven't seen your face in the place for a while."
"It's just plain old mister these days, Al. You feeling okay?"
"Sure, just thinking about..."
Al shrugs.
"Geez, I don't know what I was thinking about."
He laughs.
"Getting old is no job for sissies."
"You're not old," Hodges says. "Somebody forgot to give you the news. 60's a new 40. Al snorts.
"Ain't that a crock of you know what?"
Hodges couldn't agree more. He points to the cart. "Don't suppose my boy ever asks for a book, does he?" Al gives another snort.
"Hartsfield? He couldn't read a Berenstain Bears book these days."
He taps his forehead gravely.
"Nothing left but oatmeal up top. Although sometimes he does hold out his hand for one of these."
He picks up a Zap-It e-reader. It's a bright, girly pink.
"These jobbies have games on them."
"He plays games?" Hodges is astounded.
"Oh, God, no. His motor control is shot. But if I turn on one of the demos, like Barbie Fashion Walk or Fishing Hole, he stares at it for hours. The demos do the same thing over and over, but does he know that?"
"I'm guessing not."
"Good guess. I think he likes the noises, too, the beeps and boops and goinks. I come back 2 hours later, the reader's laying on his bed or windowsill, screen dark, battery flat as a pancake. But what the hell, that don't hurt him. 3 hours on the charger and they're ready to go again. He don't recharge, though. Probably a good thing."
Al wrinkles his nose. Is it a bad smell? Maybe, maybe not, Hodges thinks. As long as he's not better, he's here, in a nice hospital room. Not much of a view, but there's air conditioning, color TV, and every now and then a bright pink Zap-It to stare at. If he was Compos Mentis, able to assist in his own defense, as the law has it, he'd have to stand trial for 12 offenses, including 9 counts of murder. 10, if the DA decided to add in the asshole's mother who died of poisoning. Then it would be Waynesville State Prison for the rest of his life. No air conditioning there. "Take it easy, Al. You look tired."
"Nah, I'm fine, Detective Hutchinson. Enjoy your visit."
Al rolls on, and Hodges looks after him, brow furrowed. Hutchinson. Where the hell did that come from? Hodges has been coming here for years now, and Al knows his name perfectly well. Or did? Jesus, he hopes the guy isn't suffering from early-onset dementia. For the first 4 months or so, there were two guards on the door of 217. Then one. Now there are none, because guarding Brady is a waste of time and money. There's not much danger of escape when the perp can't even make it to the bathroom by himself. Each year, there's talk of transferring him to a cheaper institution upstate, and each year the prosecutor reminds all and sundry that this gentleman, brain damaged or not, is technically still awaiting trial. It's easy to keep him here because the clinic foots a large portion of the bills. The neurological team, especially Dr. Felix Babineau, the head of department, finds Brady Hartsfield an extremely interesting case. This afternoon, he sits by the window, dressed in jeans and a checked shirt. His hair is long and needs cutting, but it's been washed and shines golden in the sunlight. Hair some girl would love to run her fingers through, Hodges thinks, if she didn't know what a monster he was. Hello, Brady. Hartsfield doesn't stir. He's looking out the window, yes. But is he seeing the brick wall of the parking garage, which is his only view? Does he know it's Hodges in the room with him? Does he know anybody is in the room with him? These are questions to which a whole team of neuro guys would like answers. So would Hodges, who sits on the end of the bed thinking, was a monster, or still is. Long time no see, as the landlocked sailor said to the chorus girl. Hartsfield makes no reply. I know. That's an oldie. I got hundreds, ask my daughter. How are you feeling? Hartsfield makes no reply. His hands are in his lap, the long white fingers loosely clasped. In April of 2009, Brady Hartsfield stole a Mercedes-Benz belonging to Holly's aunt and deliberately drove at high speed into a crowd of job seekers at City Center. He killed 8 and seriously injured 12, including Thomas Saubers, father of Peter and Tina. He got away with it, too. Hartsfield's mistake was to write Hodges, by then retired, a taunting letter. The following year, Brady killed Holly's cousin, a woman with whom Hodges had been falling in love. Fittingly, it was Holly herself who stopped Brady Hartsfield's clock, almost literally bashing his brains out with Hodges' own happy slapper before Hartsfield could detonate a bomb that would have killed thousands of kids at a pop concert. The first blow from the slapper had fractured Hartsfield's skull, but it was the second one that did what was considered to be irreparable damage. He was admitted to the traumatic brain injury clinic in a deep coma from which he was unlikely to ever emerge. So said Dr. Babineau. But on a dark and stormy night in November of 2011, Hartsfield opened his eyes and spoke to the nurse changing his IV bag. When considering that moment, Hodges always imagines Dr. Frankenstein screaming, "It's alive, it's alive." Hartsfield said he had a headache and asked for his mother. When Dr. Babineau was fetched and asked his patient to follow his finger to check his extraocular movements, Hartsfield was able to do so. Over the 30 months since then, Brady Hartsfield has spoken on many occasions, although never to Hodges. Mostly he asks for his mother. When he's told she is dead, he sometimes nods as if he understands. But then, a day or a week later, he'll repeat the request. He is able to follow simple instructions in the PT center and can sort of walk again, although it's actually more of an orderly assisted shamble. On good days, he's able to feed himself but cannot dress himself. He is classed as a semi-catatonic. Mostly he sits in his room, either looking out the window at the parking garage or at a picture of flowers on the wall of his room. But there have been certain peculiar occurrences around Brady Hartsfield over the last year or so, and as a result, he has become something of a legend in the brain injury clinic. There are rumors and speculations. Dr. Babineau scoffs at these and refuses to talk about them. But some of the orderlies and other nurses will, and a certain retired police detective has proved to be an avid listener over the years. Hodges leans forward, hands dangling between his knees, and smiles at Hartsfield. Are you faking, Brady? Brady makes no reply. Why bother? You're going to be locked up for the rest of your life one way or the other. Brady makes no reply, but one hand rises slowly from his lap. He almost pokes himself in the eye, then gets what he was aiming for and brushes a lock of hair from his forehead. Want to ask about your mother? Brady makes no reply. She's dead, rotting in her coffin. You fed her a bunch of gopher poison. She must have died hard. Did she die hard? Were you there? Did you watch? No reply. Are you in there, Brady? Knock, knock. Hello? No reply. I think you are. I hope you are. Hey, tell you something. I used to be a big drinker, and you know what I remember best about those days? Nothing. The hangovers. Struggling to get out of bed with my head pounding like a hammer on an anvil. Pissing the morning quart and wondering what I did the night before. Sometimes not even knowing how I got home. Checking my car for dents. It was like being lost inside my own fucking mind, looking for the door so I could get out of there and not finding it until maybe noon when things would finally start going back to normal. This makes him think briefly of Library Al. I hope that's where you are right now, Brady. Wandering around inside your half-busted brain and looking for a way out. Only for you, there isn't one. For you, the hangover just goes on and on. Is that how it is? Man, I hope so. His hands hurt. He looks down at them and sees his fingernails digging into his palms. He lets up and watches the white crescents there fill in red. He refreshes his smile. Just saying, buddy. Just saying. You want to say anything back? Hartsfield says nothing back. Hodges stands up. That's all right. You sit right there by the window and try to find that way out. The one that isn't there. While you do that, I'll go outside and breathe some fresh air. It's a beautiful day. On the table between the chair and the bed is a photograph Hodges first saw in the house on Elm Street where Hartsfield lived with his mother. This is a smaller version in a plain silver frame. It shows Brady and his mom on a beach somewhere, arms around each other, cheeks pressed together, looking more like boyfriend and girlfriend than mother and son. As Hodges turns to go, the picture falls over with a toneless clack sound. He looks at it, looks at Hartsfield, then looks back at the face-down picture. Brady? No answer. There never is. Not to him, anyway. Brady, did you do that? Nothing. Brady is staring down at his lap where his fingers are once more loosely entwined. Some of the nurses say... Hodges doesn't finish the thought. He sets the picture back up on its little stand. If you did it, do it again. Nothing from Hartsfield, and nothing from the picture. Mother and son in happier days. Deborah Ann Hartsfield and her honey boy. All right, Brady. See you later, alligator. Leaving the scene, Jellybean. He does so, closing the door behind him. As he does, Brady Hartsfield looks up briefly and smiles. On the table, the picture falls over again. Clack.